Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Call, the Impulse Health Radio Show, and today we're pleased to have with us Dr. Deborah Smith, who is the author of Healthcare Solved, Real Answers, No Politics. This is a very timely book in that the Senate has adjourned without deciding which healthcare plan we're going to have, and that looms the one of the most important questions for early 2010 is the bill that will be hashed out in committee, I assume. Deborah, welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
From Indianapolis.
Great, great. Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today. This is a very important book. You have a unique background in being able to write this book and also bring to the table things that probably the majority of people don't even know about in terms of some of the very critical issues about healthcare. Would you like to tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in healthcare reform?
Sure. Well, actually, my background, I started off studying economics and went into medicine as well. There were two areas that I was most interested in, and really went into medicine with the idea that I was going to be working in third world countries, helping them reform their healthcare systems, never imagining that
we need
here.
Yeah, no kidding.
At the time, you know, it was the mid-80s and things were going quite well here. So.
Right, right. Then we had mangled care, as Dr. Shealy calls it.
Yes, precisely. Unfortunately, things got a bit askew here. And so basically it was my background is in insurance medicine as well. I've worked done a lot of clinical work, worked in the ERs. I've worked overseas and have done some relief and development work helping countries in the former Soviet Union reform their systems. When I came back to this, when I came back to working in the States, I wound up working in the insurance industry. And so, I had friends and colleagues, who were asking me, well, you know, what can we do? Is there some other way? It seems like there ought to be something better than this. And, having worked particularly in catastrophic underwriting, I think I know where the costs are, where the costs are and where the money's being spent. So, at any rate, that's the reason why I wrote the book, basically to help employers and the general public to understand and physicians themselves and healthcare providers to understand what we can do to make the system better, to make it more cost efficient and improve quality in the process.
Yeah, and so many of us just see it from one standpoint. You know, the physicians see it from their standpoint, the patients see it from their standpoint, politicians see it from a certain standpoint, insurers see it from another standpoint, pharmaceutical industry sees it from another standpoint. So I think where you started was very good, and where you started is where is most of the money spent? And would you like to review that for our audience? Because that really is very important if you're going to try to fix a cost system. You know, you've got to know where you're spending your money.
Right. Well, actually, about three-quarters of the cost are spent on about 12% of the population. And what happens is those are the folks who have catastrophic diseases, the folks that need transplants, the folks with cancer, people with that have just perhaps had a newborn that maybe was born at 26 weeks, those low birth weight babies. So if we're going to look at this, I think that what we have to do is we have to look at attacking those catastrophic diseases. There's much talk about prevention, but truly if three-quarters of the are at the end points of disease, and since we have an aging population, we don't have a lot of time for prevention, right? We've got to deal with the mess we have.
The house is already on fire.
Exactly, precisely. So if we're going to deal with the mess that we have, then we need to look at how we can get those people better, faster, and cheaper. And the best way, I was actually working for I headed up a medical underwriting department for a national stop-loss carrier, and those are the folks that reinsure companies who are self-insured for health insurance, those companies who can afford to take on the risk of health, of providing insurance for their people. They will have a stop-loss carrier, too, in essence, if there's a really big loss. so they don't have to explain it on their balance sheet, if you will. But I was working for them, and I actually started to look across first world countries and noticed that it seemed that even after you standardized for health system discounts, for currency, for inflation, all those types of things, certain countries had a competitive advantage in treating certain diseases. Mm-hmm. And, for example, in Belgium, they are able to do their first-year costs for kidney transplants are 25% cheaper than ours. And that equates to about $45,000. Well,
right.
I mean, you can see there's about 70 or 80 so diseases that fall into this category.
Mm-hmm.
If we could figure out what they're doing differently, either in pre-op, operative, post-operative stage, if we can figure out what they're doing differently, and if they're getting the same or better results than we are, then I think we need to do that precisely. and the truth of the matter is, all the other first world countries are actually running into the same problem,
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that their populations are getting older, and
right.
you know, basically things start to hit when people are in their 50s and 60s and 70s, in particular these big sorts of catastrophic things,
right.
all of our bad behavior from our youth catches up
up
with us, if you will.
I'm 55. I think I know what you mean. I never thought I was going to live to be 55. You remember that one? You can imagine when you were 20 that you would be over 50.
Right, exactly. But unfortunately, it starts to catch up with us. So if
it
we
sure
can
does.
Figure out what they're doing, and actually, I was on a plane that about 2 months ago and met a gal. She was leading a delegation from France, and they're trying to figure out what are our hospitals doing differently. Are there ways that we can improve with medical mm-hmm. records? So there is. If, as a matter of fact, the U.S. should lead the charge, frankly, to say, all right, let's figure out what the costs are, and
right.
let's figure out who's doing what better. And if there's an advantage, then we just need to adopt that, and that needs to be what I call in my book, at least, the golden standard of care,
mm-hmm.
the international standard that, and everything else. If someone else comes up with something, you know, that beats it, well, great, we'll go with that then. But proceed from there.
Well, that's a great idea, and I think that that's actually a very intelligent way to approach the problem. I had done some reading on this in past years and realized, like your book points out, that the majority of money spent on healthcare is actually spent within the first year of life, and then the last couple of years of life.
About the last 2 years, right?
Right. So. And then when I became a plastic surgeon, I saw all this money we were throwing at, like these pressure sore wounds, which are tremendously complicated in people who are bedridden with Alzheimer's. Well, that's kind of dumb. You know, I mean, why spend $50,000 to fix a bed sore in someone who's, you know, got a prognosis of never getting better and never being able to get off the pressure off the area? So, you know, working in medicine for 26 years, I see an incredible amount of ability to save money that isn't
right.
taken either because
well, you
and,
know
and
the
a lot
challenges
of it,
are.
Yeah, especially with malpractice, you know, the ordering of tests and unnecessary scans and everything just to cover your ass, so to speak.
Right. Well, and that's why I, at least in healthcare, so they talk about the fact that what we really need to do is have a peer review panel to say, is this really malpractice or is it not? And look at it. The issue, supposedly in our country, we are supposed to have a jury of our peers, but in medicine, we force poor lay people to look at the medical records and say was there malpractice or not. And often, it's who has the best lawyer wins, which
is
not really fair to anyone.
Right.
And if we could say, okay, if there was determined to be an issue, go ahead and if a peer review panel gave an opinion and said here's where we believe that there was an issue, then that should go on to a regular trial jury and that sort of thing, and damages awarded accordingly by that group. But if you consider that a few years ago there was a study in Ohio, and they looked at malpractice cases, and about 80% of those were, frankly, there was no award. So we would consider those basically frivolous.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of money defending
of
that,
money.
And a lot of money and a lot of time and frustration on everyone's part.
Oh, yeah. And you know, until the doctor's company came along, which is run by doctors, and because of that is a lot more intelligent in terms of prevention of malpractice cases. You know, they have us use specialized forms for things that are high risk, so that informed consent becomes very central to, you know, the surgery, so that if you do have a complication, the patient can't say they didn't hear about it.
Right.
And so just being a part of the doctor's company, which actually was founded by a plastic surgeon, and but has all the different specialties on it. And what I like about the doctor's company is that they will settle no claim without your permission. So there's none of this ridiculous stuff where insurance companies settle every claim that comes through,
right,
thereby propagating frivolous lawsuits.
Well, yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
Anybody that knows that a claim's going to be settled, it will just bring whatever. You know, there doesn't have to be a basis for the claim. And then that drives costs up terribly.
Sure.
So you have to be prepared to defend yourself. You have to, you know, you have to know how to do that, and then you have to have done things around the time of surgery, around the times of treatments, to, you know, so that you can defend yourself. Because things are always going to go wrong in medicine. I mean, as a doctor, you know that. You know,
certainly.
Allergic reactions occur. I mean, you know, there's, I mean, bad outcomes occur even with the best intentions. And,
right. And the thing is, a bad outcome is not necessarily malpractice. And I think that's something that's not necessarily understood by the public. Certainly the lawyers propagate everything as malpractice. But you do have people who are high risk, and frankly, if you've got a person who has had extensive coronary artery disease, there are a certain number of people who won't make it through the anesthesia and the surgery.
Absolutely.
And it's not that anyone did anything wrong. It's just that their body wasn't able to handle the trauma.
It's like a big stress. You know, it's like they ran 3 miles. And as we know, with coronary artery disease, a certain percentage of the time when you decide to run 3 miles, you're not going to make it to the other end. I mean,
precisely.
It's the way it is. And, I mean, the only thing you can really do with those patients is not do them without a huge amount of support. You know, do them in a hospital that has cardiac surgery. And, you know, I mean, you can take precautions, but you can't dictate
even in the best of circumstances.
You know?
Yeah, even in the best of circumstances. You can do all the right things and the patient still dies.
That's right.
It doesn't necessarily mean that somebody did someone wrong.
Yeah, we used to, when we were residents, it turned out that the medicine team would always, right before the patient was about to die, consult surgery just in case there was something we could do. And so my boss, my chief resident, wrote in Latin, in perfect calligraphy, "Let sleeping dogs lie." And boy, did he get in trouble for doing that. That was in the Air Force.
Oh, I'm sure.
That was funny, though. He was really good at calligraphy. So they didn't see his sense of humor. I thought it was hilarious. But he got tired of, you know, the last hour consult. You know, the patient was going to die within the hour, and they consulted the surgery to see if we wanted to operate on him. You know? But
terrible.
It is.
What can you do?
No. They just wanted to make sure they hadn't missed anything. You know,
exactly.
Their intentions were good, too. But I think the surgical team got tired of it.
The emergency called, no doubt, and paid.
That's right. Yeah. Well, this, as I said in my introduction, this book is very timely. Did you know that all of this was coming about in 2009? I mean, did you, when you wrote this book, were you aware?
Well, I'll tell you, I have been considering this for a really long time, looking at things and saying, this is how I think it ought to be. And having worked, especially for an international insurer, you look and you see what other countries do or they don't do.
That's important.
And you say to yourself, you know, there are some things that are really that they do really well, and having worked overseas, and other things that are not so good, and you say to yourself, I think that we can build a better system here, and particularly since I knew, actually started the book this spring, and but since I've been thinking about the ideas for so long, I was able to write it in a relatively short period
of time. You sure did. Not bad.
But it was really the ideas and the work for it, if you will, had really been there for a number of years before, and thinking about how things ought to be more efficient, we could make things more effective in our healthcare delivery.
I especially like your analysis of some of the systems, you know, Canada and Europe, and pointing out that they're really not free. You know, that's a good point.
That's right. People pay for them in their taxes.
Exactly.
Or if they're not paying for it in their taxes in an income tax kind of way, they're paying for it, or their employers are paying for it in through taxes through their employment. It's a separate category for their health insurance. For example, France and Germany, they split it two-thirds to the employer and one-third to the employee. So it's not free. In this country,
the price kind of goods, you know, services, you know, it drives everything up. I mean,
that's right.
It has to.
Oh, of course, of course.
Economically, I don't think people in the U.S. understand economics. What do you think?
Well, I think that our press should do a better job of explaining.
Exactly.
I don't expect
somebody has to pay
everyone
for it, you know,
to understand every area. I thought that was the job of the press, was to help us understand.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it seems that they've taken a view. Either they don't understand it, or they've taken a view and not looked at the situation objectively, and they've not brought any real objective analysis of what is really going on in other countries, because it's not just a case of it's free for other countries. It's not free.
Someone has
to pay for it somewhere.
Right.
It surely costs. Yes, it may cost 60% of what it costs here, so they're operating at a 40% discount, but it still costs. And if you consider how much it costs, for example, a person who had an abdominal pain and an infection, for example, it might cost it for them to go to the ER and stay overnight for observation, have some IV antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
It may cost about $6,400 here for that whole workup. Even at a discount of 40%. It's still costs. So I think that we need to think about this a little bit differently than it's free elsewhere, and you know, we're having to pay.
Right. And you know, a lot of the, if you really analyze it, a lot of the difference in price has to do with the less litigious environments in these countries compared to here. You know, you've got to factor in here the cost of medical litigation.
Well, that is a significant factor. If you look particularly, and the other issue is got to be the whole medical record situation.
Yeah.
Fact that as a physician, for example, if you have to write down everything that you've done, or you haven't done it, that's the legal standard, if you will.
Right.
Whereas other countries write only the positive, pertinent positive, or pertinent negative. As a matter of fact, it's really pertinent positive, because they don't sue to the degree that we do here. It's much less frequent. There's the assumption that the doctor actually knows what they're doing. And no, that's very true. They assume that. And unless something was hideously wrong, that you don't have the malpractice cases that you do here. But as a friend of mine who said it was in Holland said, we assume our doctors know what they're doing, rightly or wrongly, as the case may be, but there's that assumption. But the big issue, I think, is the fact that there is a lot of waste around medical records. Now, the government wants to throw money at the situation and is, I believe, planning on doing that. There's been at least $18 billion out of that stimulus funding, that $787 billion stimulus funding, there's $18 billion that was slated for medical records. And unfortunately, what it looks like they're going to do is push for some trial projects and trial systems mm-hmm. to be put in place. But as you know, most of the medical record systems don't work well, the electronic systems. They're not efficient for the doctor. They really don't bring any efficiency to the doctor. If anything, they slow us down.
Yeah.
And for the most part, the studies have proven that they do slow us down.
Mm-hmm. Can you repeat for our listening audience at this point the percentage of hospitals and the percentage of private doctor's office that actually have electronic medical records now?
Yes, it's a very low percentage.
I think that's
actually
an important point.
And I think that the reason for that is the fact that they are so costly. For a hospital system, for example, it may cost anywhere from $10,000, $20,000, $100,000, depending on the size of the hospital and the hospital system.
Mm-hmm.
For an individual doctor's office, it may cost about $60,000 to set up a system to have medical records. Well, that's
right.
Not for a solo practitioner. That's really not practical.
Well, they're breaking even right now. You know?
That's right. And that's
or
why,
not.
Exactly. Exactly.
They don't have that money.
So right now it's 2% of the hospitals have comprehensive electronic medical records and only about 13% of the offices.
Yeah.
And what we do need, though, is not to have a system that is a system for a system's sake, because obviously, a urologist does not have the same needs as an OB-GYN. They do a more specified exam, and they have different medical records needs. So there's not like there's an off-the-shelf Microsoft Office version of medical records that everybody can use.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have different needs, and it's going to take some time even to develop specific to a specialty what they
mm-hmm.
need. A small hospital in North Dakota doesn't have the same needs as an academic medical center in Pittsburgh.
Right.
But what we need really is to have an electronic medical filing cabinet
that
providers can access and insurers can access, because that's the holdup. And there's a dance that goes back and forth with insurers and for approving procedures. And we have having worked for an insurance company,
mm-hmm.
I can tell you their insurers have deadlines, and
mm-hmm.
they have to say yes or no. And often the reason that they say no is because the doctor hasn't sent them the medical records that they had asked for, or for some reason their staff didn't understand what was needed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do this dance back and forth, and frankly, the insurers are just as irritated as the doctors, and who are just as irritated as the patients for not being able to get things moved.
And tell our listeners what HIPAA did for that.
HIPAA was good intentions gone awry.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, HIPAA, the Health Insurance and Portability Act, was supposed to keep our information
mm-hmm.
more secure. Unfortunately,
right.
the way it's been written, actually only 4 cases have ever been gone forward under HIPAA
mm-hmm.
and that have been brought forward. And frankly, they were a violation of the person's medical privacy under the previous law.
Right.
So it's not like HIPAA has actually done anything for us.
Right.
It has cost us billions of dollars.
Right.
It has slowed down the process tremendously
mm-hmm.
of people who legitimately need to be able to get medical records. If for your doctor's office to send them to the hospital and vice versa, it's just slowed down the entire process. It's slowed down medical research because everyone's a bit paranoid because of the
mm-hmm.
because of the fines, which may be $50,000 an incident, and which also incur possible jail time. People are afraid. I don't want to violate HIPAA.
Well, you know, the government has a very poor track record in getting the trust of physicians and other people in terms of not going crazy with their investigations and their fines and their, you know, I can tell you lots of my friends are no longer accepting Medicare because of things that have happened to them or people they know. You know, there is reason to be afraid of the
government.
That's
right.
Now,
it's very punitive.
It's very good to know that HIPAA has not gone down that route that Medicare went down. But certainly, historically, we're very, very cautious of dealing with the government. It seems that the government just wants to find you guilty of something. There's an OBGYN group here in town that got audited by Medicare and actually got really high fines because they were under billing. In other words, they were using codes that were too low. Well, that group, which was one of the largest here, quit taking Medicare. So who does that really hurt?
Right. It obviously,
I mean,
it hurts the poor patient, if anyone.
It's
not like they were overcharging, but then they, you know.
They were underbilling.
They were undercharging, right, exactly.
But still, it was a violation of those things that Medicare puts forth that says if you don't do this our way, then you get these fines.
That's right. That's right.
And the rules are very, very convoluted and difficult for hospitals to, you know, and medical practices to actually do correctly. It's just difficult. It's not, there's an intent to defraud there. And with HIPAA, I can tell you many times, I'm the ordering physician, and I have my staff call the hospital to get the lab result or the test result or the MRI result, and I'm told that they won't send it to me, though I am the ordering physician.
Precisely.
That's just so much stupidity.
Exactly.
Well, stupidity.
And
you said in your book, this law allows people just to hide behind this that don't want to cooperate with whoever's on the other end of the phone.
Unfortunately, it's licensed not to cooperate, and it affects not only healthcare. And I think that's the thing that people don't realize is it affects workers' comp. It affects areas and where they're paying the bill, either the state or insured. They have a right to see the record. They're paying the bill. They've got the authorization. They've sent it to them. Mm-hmm. It affects disability insurance.
And
what does that do? It raises the cost for businesses who are trying to be good to their employees by offering disability insurance to their employees. So we're making it more costly for the employees to be good. We're costing the state more if it's like a state like Ohio, for example, where the state runs workers' comp, or whether or not for example, in Pennsylvania, it's privately run workers' comp is products sold by insurers in the state. Mm-hmm. But it costs everyone significantly more than it needs to provide people with good benefits.
So be forewarned when the government comes up with a good idea.
Well, the problem is, and I actually have a state representative who's a friend of mine here who said, what we do is we tend to react to an emotional story is brought before us of this terrible case, and it's just a heartbreaking, heart-wrenching type of story.
So let's fix
unfortunately,
it.
We tend to write legislation around that as opposed to looking circumspectly at the whole issue and what are the possible implications and what will happen down the road as a result of this. And I think that, you know, that was really enlightening to me, at least.
No, I think it's true. You need a systems analysis of a situation, which is what your book is. So did your book get into the hands of anybody writing the legislation?
Well, goodness knows, I tried to send it to them. I probably sent it to about 30 of them, but only heard back from about two of them, frankly.
Really?
And that was unfortunate because you would think all of this talk that we want to hear your solutions if anyone's got them.
Yeah.
The one thing that we haven't talked about, and I think is really key, is the fact that they haven't the representatives and congressmen and senators, they have not looked at this from an underwriting standpoint at all.
No, they haven't, and they need to.
Which is really frustrating.
It
is a business, and it really doesn't matter whether it's a public or private program. It has to be underwritten correctly. And if it isn't underwritten correctly,
it's going to fail.
That's why all of our social welfare programs are in the red.
They didn't do it for them. They're not doing it for this.
They haven't underwritten this correctly. And the CBO is an excellent group of people, but the issue is they're accountants.
Right.
And accountants do what accountants do well. They're very good, but they look at things from a static point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is, and they write, if you read their analysis of these bills, they write in there, and there's numerous asterisks all throughout their analysis that say we cannot account for this, we cannot account for this, we cannot account for this other thing because we cannot predict how it will interact. And
mm-hmm.
the issue is, no, they can't.
Mm-hmm.
You've got good people that you've made the classic management mistake, taking a good person and put them in the wrong job and wonder why
right.
they're not going to do well at
right.
it. Because you don't need an accountant, you need an underwriter.
Right.
You need somebody who does risk management as part of their profession. They understand how to weight things. They take into account the dynamics, and this is what goes into premium pricing. You take into account what has been the past history with this group of people. What do I see the future medical costs will be?
Risk, right.
What is going to be the future risk of this group of people?
Like an aging population. I mean,
exactly.
Right there, you have changed everything.
Exactly. So, and you say, okay, now how do I believe that it's taking into account
mm-hmm.
all of those factors that you price premiums. And, and unfortunately, like I say, they've put the wrong people, good people in the wrong job. And the CBO is fine at telling you how much, you know, what's your return on investment for this highway or this bridge,
mm-hmm.
but to ask them to be underwriters is really improper.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
You have to know how much toll to collect at the beginning of the bridge to pay for it.
Exactly.
And that is a skill. And part of it is understanding what is likely to happen in the future.
It is.
Things
and
change.
The thing that I didn't understand, at least, until I worked for an insurer and worked with underwriting,
mm-hmm.
Was the fact that you do the financial analysis, but there's also a sense of intuitiveness about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That the person, the people who wind up being the vice presidents of underwriting,
mm-hmm.
which is why you not only need underwriters, you need the top people
right, yeah.
in underwriting. There's,
yeah.
there's in essence, a part intuitive sense
mm-hmm.
of what's going to happen. In treasury management, they call it taking a view.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what you have to do. And it, as much as you see the numbers, then there's also that little bit of taking a view. And that's what separates the people who wind up at the top of the ladder and those who are lower down. And you need those people who intuitively get what's going to happen.
Yeah, I guess that didn't work very well when they underwrote the insurance on the World Trade Center and included terrorist attacks.
I'm sure.
It was six weeks prior.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
Well, you know, the thing is, you can't win all of the time. You really only have to be right on 51% of your risk.
There you go. So you wouldn't want him or her who made that final decision?
Well, you'd have to look at it in front of the whole scheme of their whole portfolio.
Yeah, you would.
And hope they didn't bear all of the risk for that
building. That was an expensive one. Oh, boy. Well, we certainly have a lot of things to consider when we look at any program for healthcare in this country. And I just really thought your book was intelligently written and was, all the different things that you have to consider are in this book. And I was an insurance reviewer for both United Healthcare and Cigna, which was interesting because I was on neither of those health plans, but I was an insurance reviewer for them. Go figure that one. But so I do understand a little bit about how you analyze whether, because we had certain criteria, of course, and being
right.
a medical director, you have to have these criteria met. And I, you know, and picking up the phone and talking to doctors is really important when
exactly.
you're a medical director, because you have to evaluate, you know, what has been done, what hasn't been looked at yet, what other things could have been done. And without talking to the doctor, you're not going to know those things. They're definitely not in the medical
right.
record.
Right.
And so it's a human-to-human communication situation where you're trying to do the best thing for the patient, but also the best thing for the insurance company and also the best thing for the doctor. You have to protect
right.
his or her concerns, you know, for malpractice. And so it's a balancing act.
Right. And I think that what people don't necessarily realize is your insurer wants the customer to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Employees who complain to their company that I'm not getting the care because the company
right.
isn't paying for it, they don't want that to happen.
No,
they want to
they
keep
might switch
their
companies.
That's right. They want to keep their customers. And I think that's often misunderstood.
Yeah,
it's really
absolutely.
The fact that we need to be having worked as an insurer, we need to be good stewards of the money so that there is money to pay claims. We can't have fraud or abuse or things done in inappropriate workup done where they decide to order every test immediately.
Yeah.
There has to be a protocol. And there are still doctors who do
yeah.
that.
$10,000, I see this all the time, $10,000 worth of tests,
mm-hmm.
and they're all normal.
Right.
That doesn't help you.
Right, exactly.
That hurts the insurance company. You're still no better off.
It drives up costs. Yeah.
No better off for the patient. The patient still has that abdominal pain. You don't know what's causing
right.
it. And so, you know, we have to be more intelligent, which is why, you know, my next book is going to be on spiritual medicine, which does bring in other aspects of information. And I think we need to start looking at these other aspects of information that are less damaging to the patient financially and physically. You know, a whole body
right.
CAT scan is extremely,
the
new digital
crazy.
Ones, the radiologist right. called me the other day and said, you wouldn't believe the amount of radiation that these women get with these you know, digital CAT scans. And I go, oh, yeah, I would, you know. And we have to quit radiating everybody. We have to quit spending so much money on tests that are negative.
That's right. And I think, you know, I was reviewing a case, and it was really a classic example where the gentleman was from another country, and he was visiting his daughter, and he was having basically some left upper quadrant pain.
Mm-hmm.
And of his left upper quadrant of his abdomen. And so his daughter was worried because he had, in the past, he had a history of chest pain. And so she was worried and had apparently had coronary artery disease. And so she was worried that it was his heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw all of these tests done for this gentleman regarding to work
a
up
heart.
For chest pain. Yeah, work up for chest pain. And I saw no physical exam written in the record.
That's
there
bad.
Was no point
yeah.
where anyone looked at this gentleman's
abdomen,
examined him,
yeah.
touched
yeah.
him at all.
Right.
There was no physical exam. And the thing is, he had troponins, which we test times three, you know, three times we test that in a serial test, which has over 99% sensitivity for any cardiac problems.
Just to rule
and
it out.
To rule it out. They were all negative, yet they continued to they continued to do stress tests. They continued to scan this gentleman. He winds up having an angiogram of all things.
Oh no!
And
it's like the in test you can do,
right? And of which carries a 4% chance that you'll potentially rupture something
right.
While you're doing the test and require immediate open heart surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Wind up doing all of this test. Lo and behold, someone in there had ordered a urinalysis, and when looking at his urine, he had a high white blood cell count.
An infection, yeah.
Yeah, the gentleman basically had a kidney infection from
right,
what I could
the
tell.
Left, yeah.
And
kidneys can be in different places. I mean, kidneys aren't always in
well, exactly.
The
if anyone
you
had
know.
Examined this gentleman,
yeah, he would have CVA tenderness. Yeah.
They would have known
yeah.
what the problem was. If anyone had just examined him, palpated, they
took
would have
history.
Taken a real history. Well, granted, he doesn't speak English.
Still, the daughter probably speaks the same language.
The daughter speaks the language. Exactly. That's right. Thank you very much. Exactly, exactly.
In any language on the planet, I think.
You know, frankly, I mean, I hate to say it, but a veterinarian would do an examination of the patient.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
You know, your patient can't speak to you, but
right.
They would do the exam. Why would you not do an exam on this gentleman? And lo and behold, he had a $22,000 bill after this was over.
That's the point.
It was $22,000 wasted.
Yeah.
The gentleman never got treated for his urinalysis. For his urinalysis test that was positive. He never got treated for his kidney infection.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, all of this money was spent for no reason. And when I actually wrote to the hospital, it was a very
mm-hmm.
prestigious hospital in Boston, and I wrote to them and said, you know, please look into this.
Yeah. Yeah.
This poor gentleman really never got treated.
Mm-hmm.
Please make certain he's followed up with by someone who actually has a follow-up appointment.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I mean, other than his 500 milliliters of normal saline he was given in the ER to keep his IV open, that was all the treatment this gentleman got. And I said, please look into it. And the frustrating part is, as much as we talk about
mm-hmm.
the need for quality and quality assurance, mm-hmm. and we have quality assurance teams in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and the gentleman who peer-reviewed, who was the head of the quality assurance team,
mm-hmm.
also happened to have been on this case at some point, which was
mm-hmm.
not appropriate.
Yeah.
And basically wrote a letter, a three-page letter, justifying what they did. And, there's no justification for 99% of the time this is not going to be cardiac-related if these tests
mm-hmm.
done three times in a row prove
and
negative.
Still proceeding to an angiogram. I mean, that's
exactly,
amazing.
And proceeding all the way through to an angiogram.
And who
and
paid
no
for
one
this?
Ever...
Who paid for
it? Well, the insurer wound up paying for it, but never wound up actually physically examining this patient. That is the real crime. There's a reliance on technology sometimes that is, as one physician who trained me said, you know, most of the time, well over 95% of the time, if you just examine the patient and talk to the patient,
take a history, you'll know what's
they
wrong.
Will tell you what's wrong with them. Though they won't give you the exact they won't give you the exact medical diagnosis, but they will tell you what's wrong with them.
We,
and if you examine them, you'll know. You don't have to necessarily go right to every high-tech, high-cost test you can find.
Yeah, we were in the operating room one day, and my nurse came in, and she was all upset because her mother had just undergone a $30,000, you know, workup, and had found nothing. And she was counting, you know, just telling us what the mother went through.
Right.
And so my anesthesiologist and I both looked at her, and we both said, "Your mother has, pre-shingles neuropathy. You know, that she's going to break out in a rash pretty soon."
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, she did. But none of the doctors figured it out. We didn't even examine her or do anything but listen to the nurse tell the story.
Right.
But it was obviously in a dermatome distribution. It was on one side of the body, and it was obviously, that neuropathy you get before you break out with shingles. And sure enough, the next day she had the little lesions. So $30,000 for, I guess it was in a dermatome where they were worried about the heart, and it was nothing to do. So you don't even sometimes have to see the patient to make the diagnosis.
That's right, but you do have to be a good listener.
we just said, this is what she had.
That's right.
What she had.
That's right.
And we said, well, if she hadn't broken out in lesions yet, you could put a lidoderm patch on her if you wanted to. That's a statement. You want to throw
it.
You know.
That's right. Well,
we
the shame is that we've almost become too reliant on technology. Technology tell us, labs tell
us.
And the fact of the matter is, most of the time, a good patient history will do the job. And stop relying on the technology. Touch your patients. Don't be afraid to touch your patients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, like as you say, it's really key, just listening.
It is. When I was in medical school, CAT scans had just come out. So in anatomy lab, we had people sliced, horizontally.
Right.
And because the radiologists had never looked at that viewpoint, they couldn't, they actually had to study some cadaver slices.
Right, exactly.
In the brain.
Get your perspective.
Nobody had ever looked at that thing to know what was what. They had a large education. But
because
I was educated before that was really ingrained in medicine,
mm-hmm.
We actually were taught physical diagnosis. I mean, that was what we were taught. And you had to listen, look, feel, think, you know, I'm not sure physical diagnosis is really taught to the degree it was back in the 70s.
I think they've gone a little bit too far to the techie side,
yeah.
And have forgotten. I mean, I graduated in the early 90s, and
mm-hmm.
We were still. My school was very much into. Of course, we went to an osteopathic medical school, so
right.
There's a very very hands-on approach, and it's very important to
mm-hmm.
to touch and examine your patient. It's really strongly emphasized. I don't know that it is or isn't in other places, but I think even so, there's still too much reliance on the technology. And as my preceptor said, and I still find it correct today. It's just listening when I see what is written.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor should have been thinking about what was going on instead of just recording what was going on.
Right.
And hoping that the answers, you know, jump out at them, if you
mm-hmm.
will, on a lab test. The whole that I need to be thinking while I'm writing this down,
right.
That process needs to occur.
And
unfortunately it's not.
And also, when you look at malpractice cases, I've studied what actually gets, you know, turns into a malpractice case. It's often when there's two or three things wrong, and instead of just one thing wrong. And what we do as physicians is try to find the one answer. But if you've got two things occurring simultaneously,
right,
and they're messing each other up in your thought processes because you're attributing one to one thing when it's really caused by something more serious,
right.
That's when it goes to malpractice. I think ER had a good episode of that when the ER doctor on the show thought that the urine protein was due to something else rather than the more dangerous eclampsia, and then she ended up losing the child. You see, it's like you attribute one test result to something else, and it's not. It's something actually very, very dangerous because there's actually two
right.
things going on, a urinary tract infection and eclampsia, you see.
Right.
Which two things do occur at once. You know,
exactly.
they just do. And I don't think we teach our medical students to think more complicated than just one thing. I mean, look at how many people go into the hospital and end up, you know, with not only the wrong diagnosis, but the medication that they're given actually interacts with other medication they're already on and leads to a bad outcome. I mean,
that's right. That's right. It's unfortunate. And
they throw medicine at things that aren't even there. And that, you know.
Well, and the biggest thing is, as you say, and I see it all the time, is not paying attention to giving medications that cause further problems down the line or further interactions that cause a bad outcome, or not looking.
Mm-hmm.
Today we have people who are on so many medicines.
Yeah.
Not looking at the
drug-drug interactions.
Drug-to-drug interactions, exactly.
Ordering an MRI when somebody already has compromised kidney function.
Exactly.
And then knocking their kidneys off. Now, what does that cost the insurer?
Exactly.
And it's totally,
exactly.
totally... I mean, you don't have to order an MRI hardly in any case before you can hydrate the patient or evaluate their kidney function and decide not to give that contrast. I mean,
right.
How long does it take to really look at kidney function? I mean, you have to flip open to the page where the CMP is and look at two numbers. But do they know? No, they just order the MRI.
Not
so,
a good technique.
It isn't, and it's so expensive for the insurer.
It's expensive for the insurer and the poor patient. You put their life
the patient,
in jeopardy
yeah.
for no reason.
Yeah.
And
you could kill the patient.
It's just, yeah, we need to be thinking constantly in the process. And I feel I'm empathetic as well to the ER physicians. I think sometimes they get a bad rap for ordering a lot of things, but you don't know the patient. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's key, that the doctor doesn't know the patient. It's not like it's your personal patient that you've
right.
been working
yeah.
with for the last 10 years and
right.
and you know them. And if they said they did this, then that's what they did. they can, you know who's a good historian and who isn't a good historian.
Right.
You
yeah.
gauge
who lies
your,
to you.
Exactly. You gauge your responses accordingly.
Yeah.
You don't know this person. You don't know that they'll follow up in a timely
mm-hmm.
manner. You don't
right.
know that they can get in to see their doctor in a timely
right.
manner. You don't know what their circumstances are, and it's
mm-hmm.
it's challenging for them. So in a way, I understand that they tend to want to just order away.
Yeah.
But at the same point in time, and I've been there, I've worked in inner city ERs where it's
mm-hmm.
busy and it's hopping,
mm-hmm.
and I understand the fact that there's a tendency to just, okay, this person's come in with this, then let's just do this workup
right.
pronto, but we still need to have someone taking a look at that person somewhere along the pike, and,
yeah.
and that may be fine to do on a preliminary, as the person just walks in the door, say, okay, this is the workup that we're going to need to do. But at some point during that stay in the ER, somebody
mm-hmm.
needs to look at it. Before you go to the second level of workup,
especially
somebody
the
needs to look at that.
Somebody
yeah,
has to
definitely
do an
before an angiogram. somebody needs
listen
to physically lay some hands on this person.
Oh, really?
So that's
yeah.
the issue there.
Well, Deborah, do you have a contact information or a website you'd like to give?
Absolutely. My website is actually just www. It's drdeborahsmith.com. And there you can link to all sorts of things, some information about me, where to get my book, actually links over to the book, and
mm-hmm.
You can get the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a link on my website as well to I actually have a blog for
mm-hmm.
healthcare policy and reform. It's peer-reviewed, actually. I work with my professional college
mm-hmm.
to do that. And so if people are interested and they say, I would like to know what about this what about this bill?
Mm-hmm.
What's the latest in breaking news? And I try and keep it less than four paragraphs long, so it's short, it's to the point. It gives you, from a physician administrator's point, what does this legislation actually mean and how will it actually be carried out? So it's just the
great
quick and abbreviated version of this is how it will actually affect you,
mm-hmm.
whether you're the practitioner or the consumer.
That's super. Well, and Deborah is spelled D-E-B-R-A.
That's right.
Because there's many, many ways to spell Deborah, as we know.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Dr. Deborah Smith. Her book, Healthcare Solved, Real Answers, No Politics, is a very intelligent look at the issues from many different viewpoints, not just one viewpoint, as we often see. Next week, on the 9th, Temple of Health will be interviewing Linda Howe, How to Read the Akashic Records, which is one of the things I mentioned earlier. There are other forms of gathering information about healthcare that we need to start looking at. They're a lot cheaper. Then we're interviewing Dr. Daniel Benor on his book, Personal Spirituality, Science, Spirit, and the Eternal Soul. And on the 23rd, Cindy Dale, The Subtle Body, an Encyclopedia of Your Energy Anatomy. And on the 30th, Paul Rademacher's A Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, Travel Tips for the Spiritually Perplexed. We have a zero-point global presentation by Dr. Brad Gould on the 14th at our Dunwoody office at 7:30. And we have Noetic Science the third Thursday of every month, this January, it's the 21st. And we're pleased to have back Victor Clark for a free lecture on handwriting analysis. And I encourage you to come. I had Victor here about 10 years ago doing Noetic Science, and I've used his techniques ever since during employment interviews. It's really a great way to take a look at the psyche of the patient or the person you're about to hire, or the patient if you're a physician. You can gather a lot of great information through handwriting analysis. Anyway, we've been talking with Deborah Smith, Healthcare Solved. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a fascinating interview and very timely with what the government's doing. And I appreciate your comments on the limitations that the legislatures have, too. You know, the legislatures do not have your education. There are, fortunately, a few physicians, in the Senate and the House, but I don't think any of them have your viewpoint, having worked with the insurers and worked overseas. And hopefully we will pray for guidance during this time so that we don't end up with another bill that's simply very expensive and not very effective.
Right. Exactly. I agree completely.
Yeah. And I sure hope that they read your book. Sometime during this process, maybe during the process of the two bills being reconciled. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back next week with Temple of Health Radio Show.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute, you look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastikos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone skin and contour the body. Endermology by Plastikos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastikos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastikos at 770-457-4677. Plastikos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.
I'm sick and tired of always feeling sick and tired, and I don't want to take a lot of prescription drugs to feel better. Isn't there a better way?
Millennium Healthcare offers natural solutions to your health problems. Millennium Healthcare is qualified healthcare professionals working with you to restore your health and wellness. Whether it's a caring physician, one of our natural providers, or our natural apothecary, Millennium Healthcare can help. For more information, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012.